This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com. On October 6, 1946, the city of Cleveland hit 90 degrees in October for the first time in recorded history. This maybe was not a coincidence by Mother Nature standards. However, for the sake of this week's story, I'm going to run with it because my theory is that this came from all of the hot air from the infuriated Cleveland football fans. And it all had to do with a place that, well, it's used to this kind of weather in October. Over there in Los Angeles.
Welcome to the Football History Dude Podcast, where each episode is a journey back in time to learn about the rich history of the NFL. Your host is Arnie Chapman. Football is his passion, and he wants you come along with him to explore the yesteryear of the gridiron. So hop on board his DeLorean and let's get this baby up to 88 miles per hour. Great Scott.
This time as we step off the DeLorean, the date is September 29th, 1946, and we are in the parking lot of the Los Angeles Memorial Coliseum. We're here to witness the first game of the season for the now Los Angeles Rams. But how does this tie back into the intro before the music? Well, let's just say, football fans of Los Angeles have the football fans of Cleveland to thank. But we'll get into that with this week's guest, Jim Selecki. Jim Selecki is the author of the award-winning book, The Cleveland Rams, the NFL Champs Who Left Too Soon. And he rides shotgun this week to share the wild and crazy story of the only team that won an NFL championship, but then played in another city the next year. But first, we're going to get a quick bio from his website, and it goes as such. Jim Selecki is the 2016 winner of the Nelson Ross Award from the Professional Football Researchers Association for Outstanding Achievement in Pro Football Research and Historiography for his book, The Cleveland Rams, the NFL Champs Who Left Too Soon, 1936 to 1945. He is a fourth-generation native of Greater Cleveland, a one-time sports reporter for a daily newspaper, and a longtime business media editor and editorial director who is now semi-retired and owner of 40 Seasons Media LLC. His grandfather and father were in attendance at the 1945 NFL Championship game won by the Cleveland Rams. And now Jim is developing a forthcoming book about Art Modell. To learn more about Jim and links to his book, and also the website, you can head over to the show notes on your podcast player or straight to the website over at sportshistorynetwork.com/Cleveland Rams. Also, while you're at it, if you enjoy this show, please rate and review us over in your podcast app. That is, of course, after you subscribe for free to the show by mashing the little subscribe button in your podcast player of choice. That way you get the hottest, freshest off the press episodes well each and every week. But for now, let's get into the heartbreaking story of Cleveland football fans with Jim Selecki. So that's really it. I just want to kind of start from the beginning. I mean, let's go with the origin of the Cleveland Rams. How did it all start?
Well, I'll tell you, you know, the Cleveland had been a had several unsuccessful attempts at professional football, believe it or not, and you know, it, which is funny now considering how big Cleveland is for professional football. But a bunch of businessmen got together, but led predominantly by two gentlemen. One's name was Homer Marshman, and he was a local businessman, a lawyer, kind of a later to be kind of a failed or an unsuccessful politician. And then there was another gentleman by the name of Damon Buzz Wetzel, who had been a graduate of Ohio State, had played a year in professional football, had played for the Bears, and then also the in Pittsburgh he had played. And after about a year, he pretty much decided, he said, Wetzel said, you know, this playing is for the birds. I'm getting beat up. I'd like to be an owner. So they basically scrounged up enough money to get the Rams into a new league called the American Football League, which is now called AFL-2, because, of course, as we know, there are multiple iterations of the American Football League. And that was how they started. And they needed a name, and legend has it that Marshman, Wetzel were sitting around in their office in downtown Cleveland. And legend has it that there were a few sports writers there. One of whom was John Dietrich of the Cleveland Plain Dealer, who would go on to cover the Rams for years. And they said, "Well, we need a name, you know." And one of them said, "Well, I'm really a big fan of the Fordham Rams, who at the time were pretty big. Vince Lombardi had come from the Fordham Rams." But then John Dietrich weighed in and said, "I like that name." He said, "That's short. It's concise. It'll fit in a headline." And that was pretty much it. And that was how the team began.
Yeah, and then just kind of kept going from there. Like you said, they had multiple iterations of teams in Cleveland, but that wasn't the only city. Unfortunately, back in the day, it was just, pick your poison. What's going to be in the newspaper this week? And speaking of one of them, New York, there was kind of a correlation there. Dan Reeves, how did that all go about?
Well, Dan Reeves, yes. So that's, kind of flash forward in there a little bit. You know, after the Rams jumped at the NFL in 1937 and had kind of this pretty mediocre debut. In fact, they were 1-10 in 1937. It was a record for futility in professional football in Cleveland that unfortunately would go unmatched until 2016 and 2017, when the Browns would go 1-15 and 0-16. But here's Dan Reeves, who is, as you said, was in New York City, was a native of New York, grew up in Fifth Avenue, was sort of to the manor born. His family was wealthy. They had money from a grocery chain called Daniel Reeves. And they sold that chain to Safeway, and I think for something like $15 million, which is just – that'd be hundreds of millions of dollars today. And so Dan got – he was a young guy at the time. He was, I think, 29 years old. And he had all this money, and he really had two things he wanted to do with the money. One is he wanted to buy a seat on the New York Stock Exchange because he was a stockbroker. And B, he wanted to buy an NFL team. He had been been out in L.A. in the early 1920s and had seen, while he was in college, had seen USC in play at the LA Coliseum in front of 100,000 fans and thought, "Oh my God, this is incredible." So he decided he loved football, wanted to buy a team, made overtures to pick up what was then the Pittsburgh Pirates, now the Pittsburgh Steelers. The Rooney family, of course, would not sell. Looked at the Philadelphia Eagles. They would not sell. The Cleveland Rams came up for sale, and his response was close enough. So he bought the team from all the local owners in Cleveland. And within days, rumors were circulating that Reeves was not going to keep the team in Cleveland. He was going to move them to Boston. And his thinking being, well, A, it's New England. It's nearby. It's near my home of New York. And, B, a big city, even at the time bigger than Cleveland. And Cleveland was one of the biggest cities then. And he was going to do that. But two things happened. One is that George Preston Marshall, who had moved the what was known as the Washington football team, the Redskins had moved out of Boston and down to Washington and found fantastic success in Washington. Just as you said, just like the Rams were greeted with kind of a lot of apathy in Cleveland. So the Redskins have been greeted with a lot of apathy in Boston. So George Preston Marshall had said, "Don't even bother. Don't even bother taking your team to Boston. Boston's not a big football town," which is laughable now when you think about the Patriots' success. But it was also that there was a big letter-writing campaign, and there was a lot of civic energy even then that grew up around the Rams and kind of prevailed upon Reeves and said, "Hey, you need to keep your team here." And that was really how the Rams stayed in Cleveland in 1941. But of course, as from the book, that was not the last for very long after that.
You mentioned this doesn't necessarily have anything to do with football, but he wanted to buy a seat on the New York Stock Exchange. What does that even mean?
That's a good question. I'm not really sure exactly what that means, but that's an excellent question. I guess probably at that time, that was how you got access. There's probably somebody in your audience who would know better than us. But yeah, that's the legend that I saw. Those are the two things. And in fact, he went on to continue to be a stockbroker for years after that. When he moved to L.A., Reeves, he went all Hollywood, as many people said. He went from wearing suits and ties, to that 50s, 40s, and 50s style of open collar shirts. But he still did have a stock brokerage, even in L.A., and that continued to be, a source of his income.
Yeah, I guess maybe I don't know. Nowadays, we can just go on our phone and we can exchange stocks. So it was probably different back then. And yeah. I would think that just everything was different. You know, the good old boys with the, you have the money and buy a team and league. And now there's a lot of different kinds of restrictions. There were some other things that happened. I mean, what are some other events around the Cleveland Rams?
Well, one thing that happened is in 1943, they were, you know, of course, the war was what the World War II was 2 years in. And there was, a lot of problems for all the sports leagues. A lot of the players kept getting drafted into the war. The fans, of course, were not turning out as much as you would expect. There was even talk about suspending all the sports leagues completely during the war. And actually, President Franklin Roosevelt said, you need to continue on with this, because this is diversion, in a time in a trying time, not unlike our times today, right, where the sports leagues have continued to go on during a pandemic. You know, it's like people need this entertainment. So the leagues were all prevailed upon. No, keep going. But Dan Reeves had an idea in 1943. He was continuing to lose players into the military. But just as importantly, in Cleveland, he looked out, at the time, as you know, Major League Baseball was predominant in sports. I mean, the NFL, professional football, was considered very much kind of a second tier sport. So the Indians reigned supreme in Cleveland then. And Bob Feller got, the star Hall of Fame pitcher of the Indians, got drafted into the Navy. And the following season, the Indians attendance just plummeted by hundreds of thousands. And so Reeves kind of saw the writing on the wall at the time and said, boy, I could really take a bath in the coming year. So he went to his fellow league owners and said, and he was among the younger league owners. He wasn't honestly very popular with the other owners. This was confirmed to me by his own son, who I interviewed for the book. He said, yeah, he was considered a bit of a maverick. He was younger. He was East Coast. Where a lot of the league owners at the time were kind of, many of them had been, some of them had been players themselves, like, Curly Lambeau and George Halas. They saw him with a little bit of suspicion. But here he is, a Sharpie, and he goes to him. He said, hey, I'm going to suspend for a year, thinking they were going to follow him in lockstep. Well, much to his great surprise, they said, we're not, we're going to continue to play. What happened there is that Reeves almost immediately realized that was, he had made an error there. But what happened was that the team pretty much got split up, and some players went to, to some teams, some players that went to other teams. In fact, their wide receiver, Jim Benton, ended up going to the Chicago Bears and won a championship with the Bears. So an interesting thing about the Rams in 1943 is they were literally the only sports franchise that decided that they were going to suspend operations during World War II. No other major league baseball team did that. At the time, hockey was there. And so Reeves stood alone in doing that. And as I mentioned, immediately saw the error of his ways. And within 2 months, he was like, I got to get back into this league. And so by 1944, sure enough, the Rams were back in. And they were then starting a very, almost a different era that would lead to their championship in 1945.
Yeah, let's talk about that championship in 1945, something that Cleveland fans are hoping for this year, I believe.
That's right. And it came almost as much out of the blue. Here the Rams had been, at best. In fact, they never, up until that point, starting in 1937 in the NFL and right up until through the 1944 season, they had never had a winning record. They had reached 500, but they had never had a winning record. But there was a general manager who came on board and named Chili Walsh. So he began to very stealthily start to draft players. He had the foresight, to his credit. He had the foresight to begin to realize, in that year that he had off, when the Rams had elected to suspend operations, he had kind of the luxury to begin to kind of think about, okay, who are the players coming out of college? Who are the players going to be coming home for the war? And so began to build a team in 1944 that was pretty good. But what was really took him over the top was that he drafted a quarterback out of UCLA named, of course, Bob Waterfield. And Bob Waterfield had been a little bit of a dark horse draft pick. He had been seen as very talented at UCLA, but UCLA at the time was considered kind of a second fiddle team in California to USC. And he was also known to be a little bit temperamental, a little moody, you know, not really leadership material per se. And yet another fact about him that was confirmed, you know, to me by his own son, who I also interviewed for the book, you know, that was just the way he was. He was a laconic kind of guy. You know, but he was incredibly talented, an incredibly talented passer. And so when the Rams started, went to training camp in 1945 in Bowling Green, Ohio, you know, the Chili Walsh, the general manager, he brought in his brother, Adam, to be the head coach. Here's two Los Angeles natives, by the way, who are beginning to run the Cleveland Rams. And of course, then with their star quarterback, Bob Waterfield, who again is from Southern California. So there's a third piece of the puzzle. And of course, Bob Waterfield is married to Jane Russell, who is one of the top Hollywood movie stars at the time. So you got all this kind of LA allure that's kind of coming into the Cleveland Rams franchise. But they go into training camp and they're beginning to realize, you know, we're pretty good here. You know, and sure enough, they were. They went 9-1, got into the playoffs. You know, then back then, and it was only the 13th championship game of all time in the NFL. Faced the Washington Redskins against the very famous Slingin' Sammy Baugh, who is considered, you know, now a Hall of Fame quarterback. And believe it or not, coming into that game, were considered to be the favorites. You know, some people have since said, oh, you know, the Rams were underdogs because the Redskins were one of the premier organizations at the time. But really, the Rams had looked pretty solid, and they came in as slight favorites in that game. And it's an interesting story about that game. The one is that the weather was absolutely, you know, terrible. And anybody who's ever lived in Cleveland or ever has, you know, spent much time in Cleveland knows how capricious the weather here can be. The week before the game, and I just read this the other day, they said, well, Gil, the game was sparsely attended. Well, actually, given the fact that it was 0 degrees, it was actually fairly well attended. There were 32,000 people who were in Cleveland Stadium on the frozen Lake Erie. And really what had happened was they sold about 30,000 of those tickets the week before when it was about 60 degrees in Cleveland. And they thought, wow, this is good. We are going to break all sorts of attendance records, you know, for an NFL championship game. But then, you know, the weather rolled in Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, a cold front moved in. It started to snow. Snow started to pack the field. They tried to put straw down the field to kind of insulate the field. And the ticket sales just dried up. You know, many people opted not even to even go to the game. Many people had tickets and opted to stay home. My own father and grandfather were at that. Sorry about that. My own father and grandfather were at that game, and they had said that at the time they said that you know, they had considered not even going to the game because it was just so cold. But they had free tickets, so that's what gave them the impetus to go to the game.
Yeah, I mean, a chance to go to a championship game is, of course, then again, hindsight, knowing what would not knowing what would have happened. I mean, not too long after the championship game, how did your father and grandfather react to what happened after the championship game?
Well, I'll tell you, you know, first of all, you know, even reaction to the game itself, you know, and maybe we'll talk about that for just a second because it was an incredible game. You know, my dad was 10 at the time. And the only reason why they were at the game was because my father was a restaurant owner and a vendor had said, hey, you want some tickets to the game? And my grandfather said, well, sure, I guess I'll take my son, you know. And so my dad remembers it was so cold that the straw, I mentioned that there was straw in the field that they used to insulate the field. And then right before the game, you know, the morning of the game, they kind of moved the straw to the side of the field. And it was so cold that many people took that straw, took it up into the stands. And believe it or not, and it's just probably people who know the dog pound, et cetera, probably won't be surprised by this, but they lit it on fire to warm their hands. And my dad's is one of his recollections is that his father said, hey, don't, you know, stay away from the fire in the stands here. Just stay here next to me. But it was an incredible game in that what really spelled the difference in the game was that there was a safety that happened. Sammy Baugh was deep in his own territory, backed up of what today or what was in old Cleveland Stadium was the dog pound. And threw a pass to his left to a guy who was a receiver who was streaking down the left sideline. and thought for sure he had a touchdown. In fact, the receiver said, oh, man, you know, that was a surefire touchdown. And said the ball bounced off the upright, skittered back into the end zone and went out of bounds. And everybody just kind of froze, you know, and said, well, you know, what exactly does that mean? And in fact, my father recalls that as well. He says, you know, I remember just sitting there for a minute or two. Nobody knew what had happened. And then they put 2 points on the scoreboard for Cleveland, and it was a safety. And that ended up being the margin of the game. The Rams won by the score of 15-14. And yeah, in the aftermath of that game, very interesting what happened with the Rams, because you would think so 3 weeks later, Dan Reeves announces that he's moving the team to Los Angeles, which, you know, just really kind of rollicks, you know, the whole league. You know, this was something that, first of all, that you would move a championship team 3 weeks after, you know, from the city 3 weeks after they won. And hence why I have, you know, the name in the book, you know, the subtitle is the NFL champs who left too soon. The Rams as a franchise were just cresting in terms of competitiveness. The city of Cleveland was just beginning to crest in building interest in professional football. And, So, but the fact that the Rams would move out west, when no team at that time, there was not a single major league sports franchise west of the Mississippi River, the fact that they would move that far west was just considered insane. And but here in Cleveland, the reaction was a little bit blunted because there was a newspaper strike. It pretty much shut down all the major newspapers here in Cleveland. I think there were 3 or 4 of them at the time. Shut down a couple newspapers in Akron, just south of here. And so what happened, and as we know, radio and everything else was kind of built at the time on the news that happened in the newspapers. So it wasn't even reported in the newspapers. So as I talk about it some length in the book, it kind of blunted that reaction. The other thing that happened was that the Cleveland Browns were, of course, coming on the scene. The Browns were supposed to start play in the All-America Football Conference in 1945. They kind of smartly said, you know, let's hold off for a year because our players are still coming back from the war. So they held off, but they're coming in 46. So Clevelanders were thrilled. They were like, okay, so we're losing the Rams, which really is not very good, you know, and how dare they would do that. But at least we got the Browns, and we're hearing they're going to be pretty good. And Arnie asked about how my father reacted. Here's how my father remembers it. He said, all I remember is that the Rams, I went to the Rams championship game in 1945. It was cold. It was snowy. It was kind of boring. He said, and then the next year he was at the debut game of the Cleveland Browns against the Miami Seahawks in Cleveland Stadium on an August night. And as you probably know, the AAFC used a white football at the time. And it was a warm night under the lights. And my dad said, wow. As I say in the book, for my dad, it was like almost going from black and white to a Technicolor sort of movie. He was immediately enthralled by the Browns. And that's honestly what happened with a lot of Clevelanders. You know, when they won those that first championship in 1946, you know, the Rams are kind of quickly, you know, very quickly forgotten. In fact, as I talk about in the book, forgotten maybe far faster and far more than anybody might have reasonably kind of expected, you know?
I mean, you mentioned how they went out on a because of the paper strike. I wonder how much of that had to do with they already had intentions and they were going to do it later, but then they're like, ooh, here's our chance to get out quick and cleaner. We don't care. We're just going to leave regardless. And then speaking of that too, with the Browns coming in, I mean, there was a pretty famous and let's say productive quarterback that came with that team too, huh?
Yeah, exactly. With the Browns, you're talking about Otto Graham, of course. So yeah, so the Browns come in and they, and so you have now you have the two franchises here, right? Two franchises, both with Cleveland lineages, and they're set up to be these two superstar franchises in the late 40s and heading into the 50s. Very comparable. They have in some respects, you know, you got the Rams are in the Los Angeles Coliseum, which seats, you know, about 100,000. The Browns are in Cleveland Stadium, seats about 80,000. You know, they get these big name kind of glamorous quarterbacks. And in fact, they played each other, the Browns and the Rams, 3 times for the championship in the early 50s. And of course, the Browns won 2 of them. And it's interesting to even look at the coverage back when the Rams came back in 1950. And unless anybody thinks that there was no umbrage that was held against the Rams, You know, when the Rams came back here in 1950 to play the Browns for the NFL championship game, it was like they were treated, you know, and rightfully so. They were treated as, you know, as traitors. They were, you know, people didn't forget that quickly in 4 or 5 years that the Rams had just kind of pulled up stakes. And the other thing is that while the Browns were great, you know, the All-America Football Conference was, after a couple years, was found to be a pretty inferior league compared to the National Football League. And frankly, and it may be surprising, but, you know, Browns fans, after a couple years, as we know, the Browns won the championship in all 4 years of the All-America Football Conference before it folded. And by year three, it was getting a little bit old, you know, so they were kind of like, so they were they're really raring to get back into the big time. Even then, the National Football League was considered the National League. It was the big leagues. And with Otto Graham and all those great players in the 50s, Cleveland was glad to be back.
Yeah, I mean, at least they had a team, like you said, just kind of like trains in the night passing. And now here comes the Browns versus the Rams. And like you said, there was a lot of, I don't want to say bad blood. I just had to look up that word umbrage. I didn't know what that meant, but now I understand. But now I got you.
Yeah. It's a writer word, you know.
right. Yeah. I mean, but why LA? Why go so far west when there was no other teams before?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, and of course, even at the time, California was very populous. Even at the time, I mean, it was the fifth largest city in the United States at the time. Cleveland, believe it or not, was sixth. I came across a Life magazine story, and actually, there was a nice feature on Bob Waterfield and his wife Jane Russell, and you know, it's kind of a kitschy photo, you know, photo session that was taken within League Park, you know, where Jane Russell was holding the football for Bob so he can kick the ball, you know, when those kind of kitschy mid-40s photo sessions. But anyway, another story in that same issue talked about how horrible the traffic in Los Angeles was. So, you know, so again, lest anybody thinks that was a later thing, you know, California was already booming at the time. And of course, college football was huge out there. You know, USC was considered a preeminent football program, you know, one of the top football programs in the country at the time. But was interesting is that Major League Baseball had not yet made it out to California, and the way the NFL owners thought at the time was, they were like, we're only going to put a franchise in a city where there's already a Major League Baseball franchise. So it's kind of, it would be, you know, incredible for people today to think that the NFL could be in such a secondary position to Major League Baseball. But that was indeed the case then, you know. So the NFL kind of just followed in the, you know, in the wake of Major League Baseball, you know, and which is why, as you probably know, why today, you know, we have the Chicago Cubs and then we have the Chicago Bears, you know, we have the Detroit Tigers and we have the Detroit Lions. You know, it was always kind of like, you know, kind of a me too kind of thing. And but there was no Major League Baseball franchise out there at the time. And so, the NFL was like, well, you know, we're not going to go out there. It's not that market's not been developed or cultivated, by Major League Baseball. Of course, the other thing is just flat out just sheer logistics. You know, the NFL at the time was kind of a parochial league, kind of is still to this day, you know, kind of very insular, a little bit, very almost overly self-confident. And it was mostly centered, of course, in the Northeast and in the Great Lakes. And those guys were fairly frugal guys. You know, they were like, that's insanity. You know, how much is that going to cost for us to take a team all the way out to Los Angeles to play you guys? You know, the All-America Football Conference was starting up. And they were like spending money like, you know, like drunken sailors in the eyes of the NFL. You know, All-America Football Conference had, you know, as I mentioned, they had a team in Miami. They had two teams in California. They had the LA Dons. They had the San Francisco 49ers. And they announced that they were going to do this crazy thing, which is they were going to actually send their players to games using airplanes, you know, which is the NFL was like, that seemed like a, you know, a ridiculous sort of extravagance. But at the time, Dan Reeves, as he tried to talk them into moving out to LA, out to California, saying, hey guys, you know, there was already a westward movement even then of the population in the United States. California really boomed in World War II because a lot of the defense contracts were done out there. So as he tried to convince them why the NFL needed to be out there, you know, he said, and this is always cracks me when I come across this. He reassured them. He said, look, I don't know why you guys are making a big deal about this. You know, the train ride from Chicago to LA only takes 45 hours. So, you know, so 2 days out there, 2 days back. What are you guys complaining about? You know, but it was just, I mean, it's just, it's a lot of those things. It's cultural. It was financial. It was, you know, a reticence to go into a market that had not yet been proven by Major League Baseball.
Great, Scott. I'm going to mash that pause button real quick and tell you about a new segment where I'm going to promote another sports history podcast on the Sports History Network, which is the headquarters for your favorite sports yesteryear. This week, we get to hear from Darren Hayes over at Pigskin Dispatch.
Hello, my football friends. This is Darren Hayes of the PigskinDispatch.com, and I'm here to tell you about the Pigskin Daily History Dispatch, which is a podcast that covers the anniversaries of gridiron events throughout history on a day-to-day basis through the football history headlines. As bonus coverage each day, the legends of the Pro and Football Halls of Fame are remembered on the anniversaries of their birth, and their careers are highlighted in tribute to what they brought to the gridiron. Please join us daily on the Sports History Network, PigskinDispatch.com, or your favorite podcast provider to bring you the memories of the gridiron. Iron one day at a time in the Pigskin Daily History Dispatch podcast.
All right, let's take a hit of that 1.21 gigawatts and get back into this thing.
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking at the PowerPoint that you use here, and the NFL in 1946, where it shows all those teams totally clustered up in the Northeast and then the one way over there to the West, the only one west of Mississippi, and then, of course, the expansion thereafter. That was what I was curious about the whole, you mentioned that, yeah, they were kind of hesitant to putting a team over there. I mean, what did he ultimately do, or what was the result of how he was able to convince them to go out there?
Well, what he did was the main rationale that he used, because the owners were very much opposed to it. You know, when he went in there, it was a very tumultuous NFL owners meeting. It happened in January in 1946 in New York City. Very tumultuous. Again, I mentioned that, you know, Dan Reeves was not a real popular guy with those owners. You know, and you know, their attitude was, you know, how dare you, kind of a young whippersnapper, tell us how to run our league? You know, but Reeves. Really, you know, he used everything he had to bear. He said, first of all, the All-America Football Conference, you know, they already had one defection. They already had a team called the New York Yankees, believe it or not, that had jumped from the NFL after 1945 and jumped over the All-America Football Conference. So they already had one defection. And so he kind of gave that kind of veiled hint, like, you know, I might do the same thing. The other thing he said, you know, do you guys think it's smart that we're going to kind of open up our Western flank, so to speak, to the All-American Football Conference? We're going to let them put two franchises out there, you know, and we're not going to have one. So, you know, so his rationale also was, you know, let's get a team out there. Let's not just, you know, sort of concede that booming sort of, you know, area of the country. And that was pretty much it. And the other thing is, he said he even threatened he might move the team to Dallas. You know, I mean, I have a friend who grew up a Cowboys fan, and I said, could you imagine if the Rams had been your team instead of the Cowboys? And he kind of shuddered at the thought of, you know, that being the case. And in fact, the other thing Reeves even explored was potentially a move to Cincinnati. You know, decades before the Bengals began there. So he was just bound and determined. He was like, I'm going to LA. Nothing's going to stop me, you know, and that's what happened. Though there's one thing that stood in his way, and he wanted that LA Coliseum. He was just bedazzled by this 100,000 seats. And I don't know if you've ever been there. It certainly is a monstrous, you know, stadium. It's up close. It's not nearly as glamorous. I was at a game there a few years ago, and not nearly as glamorous. I may get some, you know, some bad emails from LA fans, but it is, you know, kind of a historic park, obviously, and a, you know, stadium. And but what was standing in his way, though, was that as the Rams moved out there, there was a group of black sports writers, and they had been for years have been agitating over the fact, and rightfully so, that the NFL had been segregated since the early 1930s. They had stopped signing black players, even though the NFL, its heritage began with black players. I mean, the very first NFL champion in 1920 was the Akron Pros, and they had a black coach. But by the early 30s, there was kind of an unwritten, you know, unspoken sort of rule that the NFL owners are not going to sign black players. And I asked Joe Horrigan at the Pro Football Hall of Fame, who's now the retired historian, but, you know, he was the guy who knew everything at the Pro Football Hall of Fame. I said, why is that? He said, well, probably a number of reasons. He said, but I think more than anything, it's that in the midst of a depression, you know, and these guys were not very open-minded at the time, of course. But the, you know, as he said, they did not want to be seen as if they were keeping that they were keeping jobs from white players. So that was the thing. So the NFL went for about, you know, kind of a shameful sort of almost 15 years without a black player. Well, these black sports writers have been agitating, and so they saw their opportunity when Reeves was moving out there. So they went in front of the Coliseum Commission, which, you know, decided who was going to have access to the Coliseum, which was then, as it is now, run by USC. And these black sports writers said, and this was the era, by the way, of Plessy versus Ferguson, you know, which was the Supreme Court ruling of separate versus equal. That wouldn't be overthrown, I think, until 1954. So they went in there and they said, look, so it's separate but equal. And they said, okay, well, if that's going to be an all-white team that's playing in the LA Coliseum, okay, so the Coliseum is for the all-white team, where's the stadium? Where's the public stadium for the all-black team? So, of course, the commission didn't like to hear that. They didn't want to have to determine another stadium, build another stadium. And by the way, they also didn't want any sort of a kerfuffle. They were trying actively to lure East Coast teams out west, you know. And so they basically said, that's a good point. They turned at that point, they turned to Chili Walsh, the general manager of the Rams now, of course. And they said, would you agree to sign a black player? And he said, absolutely. You know, not kind of thinking that maybe, you know, that'll just kind of get him through the situation here. Well, no, that they held him to it. You know, the sports writers held him to it. And what he did was to honor that, he signed a player. Who had been from Southern California, Kenny Washington, and had played for UCLA, was a fantastic player, was never signed by the NFL, and had spent years just kind of playing for semi-pro teams. By this time, he was in his early 30s. Signed Kenny Washington, broke the color barrier, decided, well, you know, he needed a roommate, quote unquote. So they hired another black player who was Woody Strode, who would go on to be a Hollywood actor. And that, because of all that, because of the Rams moving out of Cleveland, moving to LA, wanting to get into the LA Coliseum, that was how the NFL was reintegrated.
Hmm. Yeah. I mean, going back to Joe's comments about the using the excuse as the Great Depression, I never even heard that one before.
Yeah. Yeah. I know that was an interesting one. Yeah. But it makes sense, you know. You know, and just one other thing there too, as you probably know, the other Cleveland connection here is that, of course, at the same time that the Rams are integrating their team, of course, the Cleveland Browns are doing the same thing as well. You know, they're emerging in All-America Football Conference, so they signed Marion Motley and Bill Willis. So that sport is also integrated, and oh, by the way, that sets up what to happen the following year, emboldened by the fact that these two teams were able to reintegrate. What happens then, of course, Jackie Robinson gets signed by the Dodgers, and that then now the reintegration of sports happens all over the place. So
yeah, and that I didn't realize the story behind Kenny Washington, as far as, like you said, to be able to get into the Coliseum there. That's something that's definitely new to this podcast.
Yeah, it's an interesting story, you know, and that's the thing that I, you know, as I researched the book, it just became more and more obvious, like, you know, this is a pretty important event, you know, in the grand scheme of sports history. And I was astounded as I began to research. I was like, surely there's got to be a book on this team and, you know, and the impact of this team starting in Cleveland and moving to LA. And there was not. So I was glad to see that it kind of filled that void, you know.
I think you kind of jumped the gun on my next question. It was going to be like, what was your passion to write this book? Did you have a personal passion from being from Cleveland?
Yeah, I did. It was, you know, it's a little bit of forgotten history, you know, which is, which, you know, kind of astounds me. And as I talk about in the intro to the book, what really got me going was back, you know, as you probably know, when Art Modell moved the Browns out of Cleveland in 1995. That was a pretty, you know, that was a pretty traumatic thing for all of us here. And you probably remember at the time, right around the time the Browns were moving out and going to Baltimore, the Rams were doing the reverse commute and they were moving back to the Midwest and they went to St. Louis. So, which, you know, it's for those of us, you know, in two fellow Midwestern cities, it, you know, it seemed, it almost made it kind of worse in some respects. But business was taking me a lot at that time to St. Louis. And so I would ask, they'd talk about the Rams. Oh, we're so glad to have the Rams here. And I would say, you know, okay, well, let me just, you know, test you a little bit here. Where did the Rams franchise start? And they said, Los Angeles. And I kept saying, you know, it wasn't, it was Cleveland, you know? And I was just like, you know, if you, as I would say, you know, I would say, if you're going to have a pro football team here, yeah, know it's history, you know? And I will say, that Los Angeles Rams fans, I'll tell you, they really know their team's history, more so than St. Louis, believe it or not. The Rams really cherish that, you know, the Cleveland origins. That Donnie just saw just the other day, you know, the Giants were going to play the Rams. And the Giants coach was saying, well, I was shocked to see this because this was not common knowledge 5 or 6 years ago, it seemed to me, when I started researching the book. But he said, well, as we all know, you know, he's talking about the long history of the Rams. He said, they're the only NFL franchise to win championships in three different cities. And I was like, wow, I'm glad that story's getting out, you know? So of course, Los Angeles, Cleveland, and St. Louis. So that was a key part of the passion for me, was to kind of get that, you know, get that message out. And then the other thing too, is just, you know, just as from a writer's standpoint, probably in most people's eyes, the Rams just seem on the face of it, they're just so associated with Los Angeles, you know? I mean, just their blue and, you know, yellow colors. And, you know, as I mentioned in my introduction, you know, growing up, just, you know, thinking of, you know, watching Merlin Olsen and Roman Gabriel and, you know, those players, and, you know, seeing the palm trees of Southern California. I didn't really learn until I was maybe 12 or 13 that the Rams had started in Cleveland. I was like, really? I had no idea. And then just the fact that Bob Waterfield and then also Jane Russell, who, for, you know, for those of who don't know, but I mean, she was as famous in her time as Marilyn Monroe. You know, the fact that they would have been affiliated with this Cleveland, you know, with the team when it was in Cleveland, was such an interesting thing for me. So to get into the bottom of that was, you know, another passion of what caused me to write the book.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned how, like, growing up, it was the L.A. For me, actually, my era, I only knew them as the St. Louis Rams for the most part. I was too young for them to move. And then when they did move back to L.A., for me, it was like, oh, they're moving to L.A., not moving back to L.A.
Right. Yeah, they seem, you know, they always seem like, it's always seemed to me that they're much more of an L.A. team, you know, in my mind. And that's another thing as I began to research the book. I had kind of an inkling that they were going to move, you know, to L.A. It was just, if you just kind of read between the lines. And I even asked Joe Horrigan when I interviewed him, I said, what do you think? You know, the Rams, you know, this is a couple years before they moved. And I said, what do you think? You think the Rams are going to move? He goes, nah. I said, I think they're staying in St. Louis. I was like, really? Because I'm thinking they're going to. So that really even kind of got me, gave me motivation to get the book done. Because, you know, it came out in late 16, just, you know, just as the Rams were on the cusp of moving. So that was kind of driving me a little bit as well, just to kind of get that out there, you know, to hopefully capitalize a little bit on that, you know, that backstory in Los Angeles.
Yeah, I mean, Cleveland fans having multiple teams ripped away from them. I guess Detroit fans, they have in a way, but it's just because the teams, they folded. I mean, after starting this podcast is when I found out that the Detroit Lions are actually the Portsmouth Spartans before. I didn't know any of this stuff history. It's kind of unique and interesting. And I'm glad that with the NFL 100 and the 100th birthday, a lot of this stuff is being out there more. And maybe that's why, you know, they're talking about it more in the games, yeah, and such.
I would hope so. I mean, it's a fascinating history. In fact, but Portsmouth, if you ever get a chance, if you're ever in Ohio, that stadium is still there. So if you're ever interested in walking in there, I happen upon it in Southern Ohio. And it's fascinating to go in there and walk around that stadium and think that an NFL team played there, you know, in the late 20s and early 30s. But yeah, you know, that's another thing that Joe Horrigan said, you know, that, and I agree with him. He said more than baseball, you know, for sure, you know, the NFL, pro football does not honor its history nearly as much. And you know, I think it's kind of manifested when people say, well, what, you know, when did the NFL really become, what's the modern era of the NFL? you know. And I mean, baseball, as we know, they go, you know, if something happened in 1925, it's as relevant as if it happened in, you know, 2005, as far as baseball fans are concerned. But, you know, football fans, you know, a lot of football fans are like, well, that was just the era of the leather helmets, you know. And it's really unfortunate. And I agree with you. This 100th anniversary has been great. It's been blunted a little bit, I know, because in Canton, they had a whole bunch of stuff that they were going to do this year, you know, around the 100th anniversary. And it all just kind of, course, got put on hold by the pandemic, which is really unfortunate. But, you know, I'm hopeful that there's going to be more and more fans. And I think younger fans really like the kind of old school. They like to hear about a lot of the, you know, the heritage and the early origins of the sport, you know, because there's some really fascinating stories there.
Yeah, definitely a lot of different things that you just kind of sit back and, I don't know, I'm a big history fan too. So you just putting myself in the shoes of the ones that came before. And speaking of putting myself in the shoes that came before, I have a little question that I ask everybody. If you could see me, I'm giving you the virtual keys to my DeLorean right now. And you can go back and point in any Cleveland Rams moment, and you can go, but not the championship, because that's an easy giveaway. Maybe something else. Like, what would you do with your father and your grandfather? What kind of game or person you talk to? What would you do there?
Well, I'll tell you, you know, the game when the Rams clinched, when they clinched their spot in the title game. So this is not the title game. So it was the game prior to that. That was also an incredible game. And I'd like to go back to that. And it happened in Detroit. And they beat the Lions in Detroit in what was then Briggs Field, or, you know, Tiger Stadium. And it was on Thanksgiving Day. And also a ridiculously cold day. Bob Waterfield had been banged up considerably, not unlike Baker Mayfield was yesterday, got banged up considerably in the ribs. They taped him up almost like a mummy. They gave him, I think, you know, cortisone shots or whatever, and they kind of set him out into this kind of really, really cold, crappy weather. And he threw, you know, which is now considered, you know, one of the great games of all time, he threw 10 passes to Jim Benton for, I think, like 300 yards or something. It's still one of the all-time great performances. And that's another thing. You know, Jim Benton was kind of, you know, he was this receiver for the Rams. And he was kind of this acrobatic sort of wide receiver. And in fact, his receptions, or I should say passing yardage, is still, I think, number fifth in the record book from that game. So, yeah, the Rams beat the Lions, actually made the title game, shocked everybody in Cleveland. And I interviewed the widow of one of the players on the team, and she said she was on the train back to Cleveland, and she said, "Let me tell you something." She said, "That was a party."
I bet, yeah.
And she said in her Virginia Tidewater accent, which is great. So yeah, that would be the game to go, because that was really the game that set them up then for the. You know, for the championship. And I think they had real confidence by that point. You know, they pretty much thought that, in fact, the name of the player was Jim Gillette, whose son Walker played in the NFL too. I interviewed him as well. And Jim Gillette actually made a prediction. He told the hometown paper back in Virginia, he said, "I predict we're going to beat the Redskins." And which, suffice to say, right there in Virginia, just, you know, right by Washington, you know, didn't go over very well.
Right.
And, but they were confident, you know, the Rams, after beating the Lions, they thought, that's it. We're going to win the championship.
Do you have any other interviews for the book that stuck out in your mind? Like, this is a story that I can't hear anywhere else.
You know, I did do some interviews. I did do an interview with Bob Grease, who is, you know, that's another story unto itself. Bob Grease was the minority owner, owned 43% of the Browns, the Cleveland Browns, when Art Modell moved the team. But his father had had put up money, seed money, to start not only the Rams franchise, but the Browns franchise. So, and in fact, I've got a book in development now about Art Modell. And so it's interesting that this family, he's still here in Cleveland, very approachable, very nice people. You know, you would never think that they had this history, but they were the family that actually provided the seed money for what are today the Rams and the Ravens franchises. You know, and as I'm beginning to write one of the introductory chapters today, worth collectively about $6.5 billion. You know, so that was a fascinating interview. Bob is 90 now. He's 85 when I interviewed him. And so he was a great interview. Another one that was really good was Buck Waterfield. And he's the son of Bob Waterfield and also Jane Russell, the adopted son. And he in when I visited him, he lives in California, in Santa Maria, California. And so I went out there and went to his house because he had told me, he said, hey, you know, my grandmother really kept a lot of scrapbooks of, you know, from Bob's time. He said, you know, you're welcome to take a look at this. So I went out there, my wife and I, and, you know, he very graciously, he and his wife pulled out these two or three giant scrapbooks, you know, which is brittle from the 30s and 40s, you know, and said, hey, you know, just knock yourself out. You know, if you guys want coffee or something, but we'll leave you alone. So it was great. So my wife and I are paging through these scrapbooks, and then one little kind of card popped out, and it was like it was a scout for the Chicago Bears, and that's literally what it said on the card. And I was like, so I asked Buck. He said, oh, I'm not sure what that is, you know. But apparently, Bob, when he was in high school, he was 17 or 18 years old. He was already getting scouted by the NFL. Had already been the Chicago Bears already had him in his sights, so, to the point where a scout actually gave him his card. So he just kind of kept it, threw it like whatever in a drawer in his dresser as a kid or whatever. But his mother, of course, kept it in a scrapbook. So that was a great interview as well, and just to see all that memorabilia just firsthand, you know.
Yeah, talk about a really cool golden nugget that you found in the middle of that you didn't even expect to find.
No, it almost kind of just fell out of the scrapbook. It was like, wow, what the heck is this? You know, so yeah, it was just fantastic. You know, old clippings, old photos. You know, Bob Waterfield was an incredible athlete. You know, if you ever knew anything about him, he was one of the original gymnasts at Muscle Beach in Santa Monica. You know, just his son remembers him walking around the house on his hands and stuff, and so just kind of, you know, endlessly fascinating story. So as I talked to various families, and I talked to four different families for this, you know, for this book, and they're all very welcoming, and it's so integrated into their families' histories, you know. And so what this coming out of this book was almost, it felt like almost a kind of a family, you know, a family recollection, you know.
Yeah, must have been some cool, interesting conversations of just nostalgia for anytime they get to talk about theirs, and for you as well. And speaking of that, we're going to kind of leave it with the teaser for your next book that's coming out, and we'll definitely have to let everybody know when that's out on the stratosphere. But for them to be able to get a hold of you, or for them to be able to learn more about your work, what would you suggest to a listener of the show?
Oh, if they want to reach out to me, for sure you can go to my website. It's cleerams.com. And you can find my address. My email address is on there, my bio and information about the book, by all means. And in fact, if anybody listening has recollections of Art Modell, I would much appreciate that. As I mentioned, in development now, I've been kind of hemming and hawing doing this book. But it seems like a fitting book, you know, bookend to the Rams book. The Rams book takes you pretty much from 1920 up to about just on the doorstep of when the Browns were sold to Art Modell. So to take, you know, Art Modell now from here, 1961, takes you almost up to the current day. So that's why I'm writing the book. But I am collecting, you know, anybody's recollections. So if they have any recollections or thoughts about what it was like, and they recall when Modell left and what they're, you know, what it might have meant to them. I also have another website that's called modellbook.com. And by all means, you're welcome to drop things there. I'm setting the Modell book up, unlike the Cleveland Rams book, which is more kind of a straight ahead history book. This one is going to be a little bit more from the fans' voice, a little bit more from you know, the fans, the politicians, people who were here in Cleveland. They saw firsthand what happened. Because the true story of what happened when the Browns left, as you might expect, is not always the story that the NFL tells or that Art Modell told.
There you go. Now you know the real story of the, now again, Los Angeles Rams. I hope you enjoyed hearing about this forgotten story. And to get the whole story, well, I really do recommend that you check out the book over at sportshistorynetwork.com/Cleveland Rams. Other than that, keep learning about sports history over on the network too. But for now, dude, I'm through if you're through.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Football History Dude. Make sure you're the first to get the next episode. Please subscribe on your podcast player of choice and head on over to thefootballhistorydude.com for the show notes and more information on the history of the NFL. And remember, dudes, where we're going, we don't need roads.